This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg, and this week I am joined by two hosts, Paul Jaisley, editor, staff writer for comic books, and Nick White, staff writer for comic books. Thank you guys for joining me this week. It's good to be back. Actually, I said that in a couple episodes. It's actually been 2 weeks since we've had a live recorded episode with all of us together. It feels good. All right. And no one can say anything to that. That's fine. It's just deadpan. No. How have comics been for you guys? I was kind of expecting you to say something there, but that's okay. How have comic books been for you this week? Or the last couple weeks, I should say.
They've been good. I'm still buying them, and I still enjoy reading them. So I guess, yeah. There we go. Comics, everybody.
Woohoo.
Yep, same over here. Nothing too much to report. Just been what have I been reading lately? Been reading and rereading Bloodshot Reborn and Divinity and some of my free comic book day comics, of which we will discuss later, I suppose.
Cool. Well, let's just get right into things then. Our comic picks for the week. So this week, Nick, your pick was Descender number 3. What's up?
Well, what's up is I think this has got to be my first week ever, maybe, or I've literally only had one book. That's fine. I'd rather stare down a week of one book and go, well, I guess I can find one other book to buy, than stare down a list of 9 and wonder which one I might be able to sneak back on the shelf. Just kidding. Anyone who works at my local comic book shop, I've never done that, except when it's been a book I shouldn't have shown up in my poll. Anyway, so Descender number 3 is my only book. Again, that's Jeff Lemire writing and Dustin Nguyen on art. It continues to be a beautiful, moody, personal story. But what's interesting is while it does feel a lot like Sweet Tooth in terms of being very much character-driven, very much focusing on one or two characters and sort of learning their background and whatnot, it does feel like Lemire is pushing himself to try new things. I do feel like he's trying to place this personal story inside of a larger world-building exercise, which I think Sweet Tooth really didn't have. Now, I think that's what made Sweet Tooth so powerful, was that you didn't really totally understand or grasp, you know, why the world was in this post-apocalyptic scenario and all this other stuff, and I think he really didn't care as much about that, which was great. But in this, it is very much a sci-fi driven story, and he is trying to build this world with all these different planets that have these different features and alien species, and it does feel like he's challenging himself to try something new. If you aren't reading it, I think we're probably an issue or two away from the trade. And as we all know, Image, gosh, it feels like Image will roll out an issue, and like the trade that will literally include that issue might show up like 2 weeks later. So we're probably a month or two away from the trade. So if you are waiting for that, I would definitely encourage you to be. It's a great book. What can I say? And it's my only book.
I picked up that series. I picked up the number 1. I liked it, but I think I'm one of those people that's probably going to wait for the trade and just to see where it goes. And if I like it after that, maybe I'll pick it up in single issues again, or maybe just continue to pick it up in trade. I really like, Lemire's story writing. I mean, your storytelling. That book seemed really cool. And again, like you said, it reminds me a lot of Sweet Tooth, but with way more world building. But to your point, I think that's what I liked about Sweet Tooth, was that it felt like it was coming from the character's perspective of the world, or since he didn't know a lot,
totally.
Therefore we didn't know a lot. So what we discovered was very natural. Like, we weren't being fed the world to, you know, in any way. We were discovering it just as quickly as he was, and it definitely enriched the story on the whole as we found out more and more things and how just nasty the world actually was. Obviously, Descender, there is a bit of nastiness, obviously, in the story, but I mean, I didn't see much after, or I didn't see too much of that after issue one or in issue one. So maybe I'll pick up the trade just to see how that story ended up progressing. But cool. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, Paul. This is it for any of the listeners. This is our first week.
No, I'm not reading the book. I never read any.
Sorry, major delays here with our audio. This is the first week we're doing a completely remote episode because I've moved and Paul and Nick live in different parts of the city. So we're sorry. But anyway, sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was just going to say, this book looks interesting. I've never been that big of a Lemire fan. I liked his earlier stuff, the X County, but... Dustin Nguyen on art makes this a little more appealing to me, so I'll probably check out the trade eventually when it comes out.
Cool.
So.
Well, to move on to the next segment, or next bit of this, Paul and I again, actually, I think this is twice in a row now, where we have picked the same book, and this week we've picked Afterlife with Archie number 8. Paul, what's so great about this book? You can go and then I'll talk about it as well.
Okay. I'm glad that this book finally is back from the dead, I guess. I feel like it's been months since the issue came out. Sorry. The last issue came out, I think, back in December, and I'm used to books taking a break between arcs. I'm used to late books. It's not a big issue. What's kind of frustrating about this title is that the last issue came out back in December, was the first issue of the current arc. So you had the first issue, and then we've been waiting for, months now to get part two. That doesn't matter, because I just love this book so much. The idea of zombies invading Riverdale sounded silly to me and kind of gimmicky the first time I heard it, but this book so far has been fantastic. Legitimately an honestly scary zombie story, which we've seen so many at this point. It's tough to actually feel frightening and original, and this book nails it. The tone of the artwork by Francesco Francavilla gives it this sort of gothic horror movie vibe that really very few zombie stories in the past few years have really been able to capture. And these are characters that I love. I'm into Archie. So it's just interesting to see an adult, serious, scary take on the gang there in Riverdale. So I'm glad it's back. Very excited. Mike, what do you think?
I feel the exact same way in that, like, I know nothing. I really didn't know much outside of, the kind of, like, standard tropes about the Archie world. You know, like, are you a Betty? Are you a Veronica? You know, like,
sure.
The two girls fighting over the guy. Oh, I couldn't even name all the characters. I mean, like, I didn't even know that Archie had a dog. Like, there's all these things that, like, I think that this is, as strange as it is, this is, like, one of the most perfect introductions to the Archie world. I think that, like, as a new reader, as someone who legitimately only knows about Archie, Betty, Veronica, and then there's, like, a fat guy or Jughead, that's his name. Yeah, see, I don't know any of these people, but they are, like, organically introducing these characters in a way that you go, oh, this is Jughead, this is Betty, this is Veronica. Veronica's family is rich, and, you know, Archie had a mom and dad, and he lived in a very great, like, nuclear family, kind of, and, like, he had, like, rivals at school, and there were the jocks, and then it turns out that they're, like, these extraneous characters that lived, like, on the edge of, like, or that are very new, like, they're the two lesbian characters that have been, like, running away together, and, like, there was the big deal, I remember it being announced about, like, the gay character in Archie and stuff like that, and, Kevin, and so, like, and he's got Kevin, his own book, and, like, all these characters, mm-hmm. like, I knew of their existence, but I didn't know anything about them, and this series, like, really highlights everything about every single one of these characters. Like, not an issue goes by where you're not touching on some aspect of these characters and fleshing them out, and obviously it's in a horror situation, but it's done in such a way that you kind of see how these characters react in a stressful situation, which obviously shows their character to its fullest extent, and... I really like this book. Like Paul said, this is the last issue was the beginning of an arc, so it was kind of like I remember the first arc ended. I was like, that's cool. That was the end of movie one. Like, you know, they escaped and everything. You know, seemed all like maybe they'll get out of this. But of course, the horror never ends when you're in like a zombie world like this. So we're finally like starting to see things outside of Riverdale as they leave, and something happened to Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and I couldn't even believe that TV show from ABC actually had origins in comics and stuff like that. Like, I'm learning about this whole universe in such a different way than I think the original Archie writers intended, and I love it. My own complaint about the series is like Paul said, you know, it's been so long since the last issue came out. It's like I feel like I don't know how many copies of their comics Archie sells. I've realized that they publish a lot, but like, how hard is like, how do I tell the Archie publishing company, like, I want to read more Archie, dude, please keep putting out an Archie book. Like, I'm desperate for this Archie book. I feel like there are a lot of fans out there who are saying that for the first time. And, you know, with this book and the Sabrina book coming out at very, very slow paces, it's like, I really love this niche thing that they're doing, this very new, unique take on all of these characters. But at the same time, like, I feel like they need to deliver. And I'm sure that the weight that we have is because of quality. Like, I wouldn't want to rush Francovia. I wouldn't want to rush this story at all. But at the same time, it's just like Hawkeye. Like, how long can we really wait before we stop caring? You know? So I love this book. I really so excited that it's coming out this week. Like, it's one of those things where I'm going to go back and read 1 through 7 because like I want to be right back with it, you know, as things come out. But it just needs to come out more often. So I don't know, Nick. Have you read anything of this? Have you read any of Afterlife with Archie?
I've been reading it in trade. I've read the first trade, which I think I don't know if that ended at like maybe 5 or 6.
Yeah, I think it's issue 5.
Okay, and I enjoyed it. I mean, I'm a huge Francovilla fan. I think probably that was the fact that it was horror and it was Francovilla were really the big selling points for me, because yeah, I can name you a few Archie characters. I can tell you that they live in some scary Americana malts and drive, you know, drive up you know, diners and all that other stuff that whatnot. But I can't tell you anything beyond that. I think probably the other selling point was the morbid fascination that all of these, like, Ewillikers characters were going to end up, you know, meeting their end in some unpleasant fashion. So, you know, when I found out that, you know, the book was actually pretty modern in terms of certain social issues and things that it was presenting, I was like, wow, this is not what I thought I was getting into. And that's coming from someone that thought, you know, I was going to see zombies eating people. So it was surprising and refreshing. And yeah, when Trade 2 rolls out, I will probably buy it. Now that I hear that you guys are dealing with this in terms of delays, I'm definitely sticking to trades, because there's nothing more frustrating than sitting around for 2 or 3 months. And I like what you guys said, that like you're not even waiting for the next arc to begin. Like, it already started and you're just waiting on the next issue within the arc.
Yeah, right. It's pretty rough.
Oh, God, that is
so worst. You're going to get Trade 2 in probably 2017 sometime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'll probably get it about 3 years before Sandman Overture finally ends its run. So at least I'll have that to hold on to before that ends. Neil Gaiman, if you're listening, you don't care. So.
It wouldn't be an I Read Comic Books podcast if Nick wasn't bad-talking Sandman Overture. So, you know, that's fine.
Yeah.
Cool. Where's we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to feature a new segment, something that we're going to try this week and see if it pans out. But we'll be back in just a minute, and we will start to talk about some news topics. It's going to be great. This week, since, you know, we were off for 2 weeks in a row, we had C2E2 last week where me and Xander and Anna talked about C2E2 and things like that. And the week before, we had a special episode of the I Read Comic Books podcast all about positive subversion. We've got a lot of news stuff that we want to talk about, but this is something that we kind of want to actually start doing on this podcast, where we don't get to every news topic that we want to, but we still think that they're worth sharing or talking about even in a brief way. So this week, we're going to start doing this thing called the News Gloss Over, or So This Happened, or something. We haven't really found a title for it. If you have an idea for a name, please send it to us, because we have no idea. Cyborg at Destroyed the Cyborg. Love to hear it. But to begin this week, Nick's going to cover a couple topics, then I will, and then Paul will, and we'll just start with you, Nick. Go ahead.
Well, unless you've been living under a rock, I don't know where that became the phrase, but within the last week or two, we got pictures of the new Joker. In weeks past, I think we had gotten a picture of Jared Leto's hair, and I think everyone went crazy over that, and that was probably all we got for a while there. And then they just went full bore and said, hey, guess what? Here's a picture of the new Joker, and the internet exploded. Now, to be honest, the internet is sort of predisposed to just hate everything anyway, but it was a pretty different look. If you haven't seen it, it's Jared Leto. He's got very silvery teeth, and he's got... he's got a grill. He's wearing one purple glove. He's not wearing a shirt. He's got all sorts of tattoos that are a little too overt about who he is, from ha 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 to a Joker grin on his forearm. And what's the word across the front of his head? Is it distressed damaged. Or demented? Or
damaged. Disturbed? I think it's damaged.
It's damaged. You're right. It's damaged. So it's great if you're having trouble trying to figure out that it's the Joker, because the subtlety is completely gone. But interestingly enough, I heard a rumor, which of course means it's not true, that, well, it was funny because I was telling a friend, I said, you know what, if you actually lose the tattoos, I'm okay or maybe all right with where this might be going. And I just heard something a day or two ago that the tattoos are not going to be in the movie. So there you go. People are somehow listening in on my conversations. But of course, everyone on the internet's mad. I think a lot of people feel that after Heath Ledger, anything after that is just not going to be good, which I think that's an unfair opinion to hold. But we have a brand new look at the Joker. It's very edgy, and I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I'm all right with this. It's sort of weird because it's like Batman. We're open to all sorts of interpretations and changes, and I think that's one of the features that makes him such an interesting and sort of powerful character that sticks with us. But for some weird reason, with the Joker, we're now at a point, maybe post Heath Ledger, where we feel like no one or no look is ever going to really be right with us. So we got the Jared Leto pictures, we got the Joker pictures. Within the last day or two, we actually got pictures of Suicide Squad for the Suicide Squad movie, in which we're going to see Jared Leto, and I don't think he's going to play that big of a part, so everyone can calm down about that. But I actually really liked it. I think people are still trying to sort out what character is what, but I think there's been a lot of positive reception to the Harley Quinn look. I think it looks great. I know Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor are both currently writing the Harley Quinn book. They're in approval of it. They think it's pretty neat. The Will Smith Deadshot, everyone panicked because we initially didn't get pictures of the Deadshot helmet. And then we did get them, so all of those people can cool their jets, because that's been dealt with. But overall, I like the look. I know some people don't, but I think it's a good aesthetic, and I approve. It's not hard to find the pictures, just Suicide Squad movie.
In particular, I really like the Killer Croc look. I don't know about you guys, the Killer Croc, I think, is like...
Yeah, I like it. Some people are jumping on that, but I think...
I mean, obviously, he's not going to look like a fucking crocodile, but at the same time, he looks way better than the Lizard in Spider-Man so far. And, I mean, obviously, these are promo picks, but at the same time, like, if he's going to have this gritty, like, look to him, I feel like it's very reminiscent of, like, it looks a lot like the Arkham Asylum games, which is okay. I mean, not too much, but it still looks like a person, but very, very reptilian and very awful. Like, he looks like a golem almost. It's really cool. And that's all I have to say about that picture. I don't know too much about any of the other characters. I mean, I know Harley Quinn is in Deadshot, but Killer Croc, I thought, looked pretty great.
Yeah, and Killer Croc is such a tough one to deliver on, because he's obviously still has to look somewhat human, but you don't want it to be too human. And I think they really hit the, you know, I think they really hit the sweet spot for that. But other than that, I think most people were like, okay, Harley Quinn, got it, Deadshot, got it. I have no idea who the rest of them are, so I guess we'll just wait and see.
Wasn't it a surprise that Katana is in the movie? Because I don't remember hearing that, like, but she's in the picture and she looks really good, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone had heard anything about Katana being in this until this picture. Like, I think that was literally the introduction for most people. And great, because honestly, it was beginning to look like a little bit of a sausage fest. So, Katana's cool. I think it's a great look. I think she's an aesthetically striking character to begin with. So, I thought that was great, too. And I think I feel pretty good about this movie, to be honest. So, that's the thing.
Yeah, I just like that it looks different. I mean, whether you like the Joker image or not, at least it's something different. And it's got to stand out, you know? And especially a character that's been defined by having different personalities. So it makes sense for it to look different. So Yeah, I think I was not that interested in the movie until now, but that image definitely piqued my interest a lot more than it was previously.
Totally. Absolutely. So that happened. That's a thing. If you're interested, I guess look up the pictures and then go on Twitter and tell people how
tell
you're
us
upset
how you're
about
upset
it,
about
I
it.
Suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us, because I actually am, you know, I'm okay with this stuff. You know, I'm all right with this until maybe the movie comes out and I hate it. But that's a thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And on an even briefer point, if you've been following our discussion about Archie, recently we've seen Archie sort of butt heads with anything and everything, from zombies and in what is this book called? Why can I not? Afterlife with Archie, you know, you've got zombies, and then most recently we had Archie, I think it's still going on, you've got Archie versus the Predator, so that's a thing. And then, of course, now, if you weren't, you know, getting your fill with those things, we've now got Archie versus Sharknado. Now, I know what you're thinking, Nick, that's ridiculous and stupid and unsustainable and shouldn't really happen. Well, first off, it's a one-shot, so I guess calm down. And secondly, it's apparently being timed to coincide with the launch of the Sharknado 3 movie, which is titled Sharknado 3 : Hell No. So if you're up for Archie fighting sharks, that's gonna
cool.
happen. Good news.
It's so ridiculous.
Yep.
And it's weird because it's like, I mean, if you go back and look at other characters that have commonly had a lot of mashup stuff, like Predator was always fighting all sorts of people, Terminator was always being put, you know, head to head with a whole bunch of different things. Batman fought like anybody and everybody from Judge Dredd to I think he fought the Terminator at one point. But apparently now the new what can we smash up is Archie. You know, the kid that just wants to have a malt, you know, at the local diner. Apparently, you know, he's now the one, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna move on to my two little pieces of news, and they're not nearly as humongous, I think, as the Suicide Squad one, because there's obviously a lot more to that one. But I, you know, news has it that Daredevil was renewed for a second season, which does not surprise me in the least. Seeing, you know, I've seen the whole series. Nick's seen the whole series. Paul, I think you said you were one episode behind. So next week, we're actually going to talk all about Daredevil, which is really exciting. But yeah, renewed to a second season, which means, at least for me, I think it means that, one, Netflix can get away with a lot of real violent stuff, which is kind of cool. Not to say that we need a lot of hyper-violence and stuff like that, but the potential for it to be there, you know, says that Netflix actually has a little bit of range, and so that's nice. But it also means that the following series, aka Jessica Jones, the untitled Luke Cage series, the untitled Iron Fist series, like, those series, like, they have a very high bar to meet, and I have no doubt that Netflix is going to be able to do them justice, and I'm super duper excited. So season two of Daredevil, I can't even imagine what it's going to be about. I mean, I have some theories, but we'll talk about that next week. But nonetheless, very exciting news there. And in other similar, it seems like we're only talking about TV stuff a little bit, or at least Nick and I have. There was news that Olivia Munn was cast as Psylocke, and this is kind of older news, but I know there was a whole thing online. Of course, everything on the internet is a thing. But there's a whole thing online about her, but I don't want to talk about that. I think that it's cool that they actually cast someone as Psylocke. I didn't know that Psylocke was going to be in the, you know, the Apocalypse movie, the X-Men Days of Future Past, or whatever you want to call it, X-Men Apocalypse movie. I just feel like every time we talk about the X-Men movies, they're just adding another thing onto it. X-Men Days of Future Past, : Apocalypse, : don't worry about it, Gambit's not in this, comma, gotcha, just kidding, he's going to show up in the title sequence. Like, that's what it's going to be called. No, I think it's really cool that she's going to be in that. I can totally see it, being a huge X-Men fan. That's going to be... how they're going to rope her in, how they're going to rope everyone into this whole series as the various horsemen of Apocalypse, whether people are going to be taken over as they traditionally are in the X-Men books, or if they're going to introduce new characters as horsemen, I'm really excited nonetheless. And on top of that, for that movie, there were pictures leaked online, as well as some pictures that were actually posted, I think, because of the leaks of the actual X-Men, specifically Jubilee. and Jean Grey cast it, or shown, and it definitely looks like an 80s movie. Like, these characters are straight out of the 80s, and so I have to credit Fox kind of for going 60s, 70s, 80s with these movies, because that's super cool to me. But there was a picture of the girl who plays Sansa Stark, whose name is escaping me, and the girl who's playing Jubilee, whose name escapes me, Sophie Turner, and
Sophie Turner.
I can't remember her name, playing Jubilee, definitely look like 80s level Jubilee and Jean Grey, down to the mom jeans and the yellow, you know, jacket and stuff. I am a stupid fanboy for the X-Men, and despite how awful X-Men has treated me in the movies in the past years, or all the qualms I may have, I am ridiculously excited for this movie, and those pictures just get me more like ramped up about like it, because if they're nailing the look, the story can't be too bad, right? Or at least I'll be distracted by how cool the movie looks in my head. I mean, I love the after the credits sequence in Days of Future Past, so like I'm already like my heart's already racing thinking about this movie. So go ahead, Paul, unless you guys have anything to say about the other two things. I kind of just flew through them.
Oh, well, I have one really quick announcement now that you're talking about Daredevil. For those that are, you know, wanting to rumor monger, I did hear the rumor that Benedict Cumberbatch will be having a cameo as Doctor Strange within the Iron Fist miniseries. So if you're looking for some wild, unsubstantiated stuff, there's another one regarding the Marvel Netflix stuff. So there's something to look forward to, I guess.
It's not a big surprise that it's getting a second season. It seemed like it was pretty popular. And plus, they have to tie it into the other series that they're doing, like Iron Fist and the Defenders stuff. So as far as the X-Men news, I'm not a big X-Men fan, and I actually wasn't a big fan of the last movie.
Whatever, man, you're just stupid. So.
whatever. I know.
No, sorry.
Paul preferred The Last Stand.
The Last Stand. That's really the one. No, I mean, it was fine. what I thought was weird is I felt like the last X-Men movie, it was all right, but the ending was perfect. I'm like, if this is the last scene of this franchise, they nailed it. They wrapped up all the loose ends. And then when I heard they're doing another one, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's save that for another conversation when Mike can yell at me for being stupid.
You mean, so every normal podcast, you mean, right?
Anyway, there were a couple books announced at C2E2 this year that kind of caught my attention and the attention of the internet at large. One was the announcement of the third part of what I guess now will be a trilogy of Frank Miller's Dark Knight series. This had been rumored for a while that Frank Miller was going to be doing a third volume of The Dark Knight with Scott Snyder and Brian Azzarello. And now we actually have confirmation that Brian Azzarello is still involved, but not Scott Snyder. And we have a title and a sort of a teaser image. The title is the somewhat unfortunate title of Dark Knight, The Master Race. And the teaser image, we have the iconic Batman on the rope from the first book and a bloody Superman logo behind him. So we're going to get more Frank Miller Batman coming our way. It's interesting. So we don't know exactly what the book's going to be about. The story, I'm assuming Miller's doing the art and Azrael's kind of helping with the writing. Personally, Dark Knight Returns is one of my favorite Batman comics of all time. On the other hand, I haven't liked anything I've read by Brian Azzarello. So I'm of two minds on this. I don't know. It could go either way for me. I did see a brief news blurb or rumor that the original title that Miller wanted to use was Batman and Superman versus the Master Race, but I guess DC nixed that because of the Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice movie. They didn't want similarly themed properties coming
That's
out so close together.
Especially since, you know, I mean, the only, I guess it's, it makes sense because it's Batman and Superman, whereas Batman versus, but like, it to me, it looks like this is just a third chapter in a series that where Batman is trying to kill Superman.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know what to make of it. I mean, I'm glad that Miller's getting work, and I'm sure it's something he's wants to do, a story he wants to tell, but it's one of those situations where his work over the past decade or so has been underwhelming, if not offensive. The War Holy Terror book that came out a few years ago was just resoundingly panned, and I didn't even pay attention to it. So, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what comes of it. I'm sure I'll read it and whatever. The other book announced at C2E2 that caught my attention for somewhat different reason is CM Punk writing the new Drax the Destroyer solo series from Marvel. If you don't know, CM Punk is a former wrestler who wrestled for WWE and sort of famously and abruptly left the company last January and hasn't been seen on the air since. I was a big CM Punk fan, and I'm holding out hope that he will return someday, although that's never going to happen, according to him.
Is he like an MMA fighter, or is he a WWE fighter?
Yeah, he signed a contract with UFC to do a fight. They haven't announced when it's going to happen, but I think he's going to have at least six fights lined up as part of his contract. I know nothing about MMA or UFC, but that's enough to get me excited to watch his fights, at least, since I always liked his work as a wrestler.
I know Tommy the Green Ranger wants to fight him, apparently.
That's true. I heard that as well.
It's more time!
So, I mean, CM Punk is interesting. He's a guy that sort of banked on his nerd or comic fandom, his nerd cred, when he was a wrestler. I mean, the guy's got a gigantic Cobra Commander tattoo on his shoulder. So it made no secret that he's a comic book fan. And he was involved in the creative element in WWE. He helped write the storylines he was involved in. So he has a creative writing background. He would write his storylines. That was part of his contract, was he got to write, you know, what happened on the air, the fictional, you know, wrestling stories he was involved in. So he does have a background in creative writing. He did do a little 8-page story in this year's Thor annual. That was just kind of a comedic sort of story. It was kind of a fun one-off about the young Thor. So he does have a background. He loves comics, and he has a familiarity with writing. Drax is a character I really know nothing about and have zero interest in, but Punk's name attached to a title might be enough to get me to check out a few issues. And, you know, he's a high profile guy to be writing a book for Marvel right now. So it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, no, I think that's super cool. I remember hearing, I heard the announcement at C2E2, and I know we didn't cover a lot of news last week, so I'm glad that we covered it this week. But like, I was like, who is this dude? He's a wrestler and he's going to be writing comic books. And I didn't think it was possible, but it just seemed like Drax of all characters seems like the best person to do that for. You know, I mean, given what happened in Guardians and what I know about Drax, he's kind of just this brute guy. And hearing, you know, that this dude who's a big brutish man, you know, is going to be writing this big brutish dude, like that just seems like a natural connection, even if it's just visually, you know. So it's going to be really cool, I think.
Yeah,
I'll probably check out number one, if anything, you know?
Yeah, me too. I'm excited. It's good to see Punk getting some work and trying some different things. I mean, look, this guy spent at least a decade wrestling, and now he's comics, something else he loves to do. He's basically living his dream. It's cool to see.
Cool. All right, well, we're going to take another break since this whole news thing is, you know, is daunting and I need to get some more water. But when we come back, we're going to talk about Age of Ultron, and then we're going to cover some stuff that happened just cover our experiences with Free Comic Book Day this past Saturday. So we'll be back in just a second.
So the biggest comic book related news probably of the past week was the release of the hotly anticipated Marvel's The Avengers : Age of Ultron, the sequel to the 2012 film by Joss Whedon. We're going to talk about the movie, and fair warning, we're going to be talking about a lot of details and spoilers about the movie. So if you haven't seen it yet, pause, go to the theater, come back, then listen to the podcast. Or if you don't care about spoilers, dive right in, because we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the Age of Ultron. Guys, what did you think about the movie?
Yeah, I definitely did. I saw it on Friday in the middle of the day, and it was pretty spectacular in terms of it being like an action movie and like a high level, like Cap gets its own movie, Thor gets his own movie, Iron Man gets his own movie, but when the big shit happens, the Avengers have to come together to stop it. I thought that, like, I didn't get that so much out of the first movie. The first movie felt like a natural plot point for all of the characters, whereas this one feels like it's in the middle of a lot of things. Because Thor 3 hasn't come out, Iron Man 3 has come out, but Cap 3 hasn't come out. We haven't gotten a Black Widow movie or a Black Widow-centric movie or anything like that, and or Hawkeye for that matter. And so this felt like this was an inconveniencing time for all of the Avengers to come together and solve this big problem that came out of Tony Stark fucking up. Or I guess the Hulk is in there too. I always forget about the Hulk. But I liked it for what it was, which was a team-up movie. It had some problems, but before I get into all of that, I mean, Nick, what did you think?
Well, I saw it on Saturday. Generally speaking, and of course this is coming from someone who doesn't really read many Marvel books, I've just, you know, watched the movies. I felt like this was way too concerned with making certain that all of, like, the puzzle pieces were in place. It felt like my dad asked me what I thought about it, and I sort of compared it to, like, a puzzle, like I said, where you're just making certain that everything fits together and okay, here's you know, spoiler alert, here's War Machine from Iron Man 2, and don't worry, we didn't forget about him, he's still in the universe, and here he is, and here's Falcon from Captain America 2, and don't worry, he's still in this universe, and he's going to play a part in this, and here are all these other characters and elements, and we want to prove to you that we've mastered, you know, creating this cinematic canon, and that we're going to connect all the, you know, cross all the T's and dot all the I's. And the problem is, like, you're so concerned about putting the puzzle together that it doesn't change the fact that once you've put all the pieces into their right spots, the image that it creates might not exactly be the most appealing thing. I felt like there was a lot going on. I felt like the battle sequence at the end of the movie was way too drawn out. And I think the sort of scare factor of Ultron at the beginning was definitely not present at the end. He felt kind of goofy when he, like, hijacked, like, the whatever that little jet thingy was, and he sort of, like, huddled up there in the cockpit. I just rolled my eyes. And I know I realize that the internet is sort of, like, they're basically getting off on the idea that they're like, oh, Avengers 1 is great, and I'm pre-programmed to hate this thing. You know, it was fine. I would give it an 8. I think most people are – I feel like it was a fun movie, but I do not feel like it was really narratively focused. I think it was more – this was more about proving that all of the movies up to this point are still existing within the same canon, and then basically setting all of the pieces in play for the upcoming movies. But as a movie within its own right, I felt like it wasn't certainly as compelling as many of the other ones out there.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think overall, I really enjoyed it. I think the story was more interesting than the first Avengers film. But the way it was handled, it felt incredibly rushed. For a 2.5 hour long movie, there felt like there was no downtime in it. And what made the first Avengers movie appealing, I think, and the reason people are excited that Joss Whedon is involved in these movies, is you get to see the characters relate to each other and kind of get more into the characters' personalities and the team dynamic. And that really didn't feel there was enough of that in this movie. You know, every action sequence was so long and over the top, it really took away from the more interesting character development stuff that I liked in the first movie. Even though I think the story was a little more interesting, I think Ultron is a far more interesting villain than Loki was in the first one. And for me personally, I think I enjoyed it because of all the Marvel movies that have come out recently, it had the least amount of Thanos, who's a character I don't understand the appeal of at all. And Linda Cardellini was in it, which automatically makes me like it more than pretty much any other movie that doesn't have Linda Cardellini. So, I really enjoyed it, sort of despite myself. You know, I was going in expecting it to be the sort of typical superhero movie sequel where it's just overloaded, and it was to a degree, but there was enough for me to sink my teeth into that I didn't mind that as much. So, my favorite part of the movie, I don't know if anyone else noticed this or it delighted anybody as much as it delighted me, was Sad Hulk in the jet flying away toward the end. There's that scene of just the really sad, moping Hulk in the jet flying away from the team. I'm like, I want to see that movie. I want to see sad Hulk on his own, you know, on an island somewhere. Give me that movie.
Yeah, we're going to have to definitely preface this with like a spoilers for the whole movie thing.
Oh, yeah. Like everything. Everything's on the table.
That being said, you guys, I have a completely different feeling because I walked out. So I sat through the movie and I was like, okay, this is going to happen. Okay, this is going to happen. And I didn't like all the drawn out action sequences to the same degree that you did, Paul. But like the things that you talked about, or Nick, that you talked about, you know, oh, they need to fill in these characters, Like to me, as someone who's a fan of Marvel and like knows, you know, despite what I may say all the time, I felt like this being an Avengers movie, when they all got together and all the characters showed up, it was like a, it wasn't a confirmation that yes, these characters still exist. It was a, these are the Avengers. Like these people, when they get together, they don't just get together to fight. They get together to actually celebrate, and they're doing things. And yes, at the end there was a big fight sequence, which was sadly lacking Falcon, at least from what I saw.
Yeah, what the heck was that about? Like, he gets the nerve to join the team, and he doesn't even show up for the fight?
Well,
what was that conversation about?
Okay, so for one, I love the heavy implication that Cap and Falcon have just been out looking for Bucky. How fucking cool is that? That's what I wanted. That's what I want that little mini movie. I want that 30-minute movie.
Oh, I didn't even catch that. It makes sense now, but I didn't even...
Oh yeah, well Falcon shows up in it when they're at the party thing, and he says
they're doing some reconnaissance.
Yeah,
like it didn't click.
That's what
for
Steve's
me.
Been doing on his downtime. Oh my god, like that's what I want, and I know that's what Cap 3 is supposed to be about, I think, but I want that little like 30-minute like mini movie or short film that's just like them scoping out places trying to find, you know, Bucky. But that I don't know, when all those characters showed up, it was one of those things like these people. Sadly, Gwyneth Paltrow wasn't in it, and like
she was just a static image in Avengers 1, so I sort of didn't even expect to get that. So
you know, but still, all these people coming together, I don't think it was so much as a hey, these guys still exist. I think it was more of a, the Avengers aren't just these five people, or six people or whatever. They're like a social group. They're people that know each other, and like that to me gave them all that much more depth, saying that like, here are regular people just hanging out. Oh shit, they happen to be superheroes, you know? And at the end, when you know they're all hanging out trying to lift Thor's hammer, you know, like one, that was a funny bit, and we knew that it was coming because they showed a teaser for it. But like, it was them like hanging out doing people stuff, and like, that was one thing that like I was mad about Avengers 24. This is going into a whole nother thing, but I stopped reading Avengers because I wanted more of the Jonathan Hickman heavy-handed fucking you don't understand this, you little peasant human like storyline that he always gives us. And instead there was like the Avengers barbecuing, and I forget that actually is a thing. That's like a thing that comics have been doing in Marvel at least for a long time, where they're just like there's just like a one-off issue where they're dealing with character problems and they're not dealing with some big threat. Sometimes they're just hanging out, and like then the X-Men or the Avengers or some like these teams have to like deal with their own inner drama. And it's a side of the characters that I don't think we see enough in movies. And so like that whole part of the movie was really nice for me, because I was like, oh shit, here's, you know, Paul, you said there wasn't enough downtime. I think that like even those scenes, even though they're high on comedy and trying to be quick and witty and stuff, like I still saw that as like a downtime moment where like we kind of got to chill with the Avengers for a minute, and we got to see them as like people that have like these, you know, goofy quirks about them. You know, even someone as great as Thor is still really worried when someone else can lift his hammer, you know, and, you know, or if someone could even, you know, potentially try to lift his hammer. So, like, I really enjoyed some of that stuff. And, like, they stumbled a lot, I think, with action and trying to determine Ultron's power level. Like, we run into this issue with, you know, when you get to these ultimate levels in stories like Dragon Ball Z, or it happens a lot in anime, you know, where, like, you get to this certain level where, like, someone is nigh immortal. They can't, like, you can't kill them because they're too powerful. And Ultron felt that way. And then they really just degraded his power as the movie went on, and it seemed to make no sense to me. But
right, yeah, like, totally. But you're like just how strong is this guy?
Yeah,
the end you're like, this guy's just goofy.
Well, yeah, and they had this heavy implication of, you know, he's in the internet, he's in everything, he's infecting all this technology, except for at the end where he wasn't infecting any technology. But the argument could be, you know, that he was too focused on his goal of trying to destroy the Earth and too focused on trying to create, you know, his evolution and stuff like that. But I don't know, I thought it was like, it was a good bridging story to kind of say, like, it was an inconvenience story rather than a natural, like, build-up story like Avengers 1 was. So I don't know, I liked it for that, and I liked it for that, in that regard. I wish that they would just make another Iron Man movie rather than making Avengers : Iron Man : Age of Ultron, but, you know, I can't force Robert Downey Jr. to do a movie again, so...
I was going to say, I mean, what was interesting about Ultron is that, I thought he was an interesting character, or at least more interesting than Loki, because the problem they ran into with Loki in the first movie is that you ended up liking him because...
He's too sexy.
Actors, he's exactly, exactly. Those eyes, once you see those baby blues, you mean you can't hate him. But Ultron, yeah, he starts off as this very intimidating villain, and then by the end... You can just feel like Joss Whedon just giving James Spader this really just like juicy scenery chewing dialogue, and it really makes the character less threatening and becomes more this sort of jokey stereotypical villain.
Especially when you like, realize he's not delivering it was on strange. Any of it.
Right, exactly. Well, you run into the same problem that you have with Thanos, where he's the most ineffectual villain ever. So, yeah, I don't know. I like James Spader, but at the same time, it's like you run into this problem where he's so charismatic that they focus more on him delivering the dialogue, this sort of over the top, super villainy, scenery chewing dialogue, that you miss the actual threat of the character at times.
But man, did he have some good lines though? Like,
oh yeah,
his whole like I love that. I don't know. Sometimes, like, you, as much as it kind of like took away from the character, like, I do have to say, like, all of the shit that he was delivering was just so well written. Like, it was so absolutely superfluous. Yeah. It was so like Joss Whedon-y, you know. But at the same time, like, it worked really, really well with the theme of the story. Like, and I didn't even pick up on this, and it wasn't until I talked to Kelly about it, but she was saying that. You know, did you catch how many lines that James Spader said that were words that Tony Stark directly said in other movies?
Like, yeah, right. Exactly.
Like
yeah.
So many, and obviously they implied that theme right at the end, but or throughout the movie. But like it was, I didn't even realize it. Thinking back about the movie, I was like, oh my gosh, like these are like Ultron was Tony Stark without the human side, and that I really appreciate that. I think if they tried to do the Hank Pym background, which is where, you know, the character comes from, blah, 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 I think it would have probably ruined that parallelism there. Because Tony Stark's first three movies is, you know, him in love with war and wanting to be, you know, the warmonger, but yet at the same time, he is grounded by all of these people that are around him and that want to be a part of his life. Whereas Ultron doesn't have that, you know. That metaphor of there are no strings attached to me anymore, you know, it plays in multiple levels, which I have to appreciate that. Like, Joss Whedon, he's going to do that. He's going to deliver that multi-leveled, you know, like, storyline. And if you look at it purely from that respect, like, I think the movie was pretty well written in terms of dialogue and character interaction and, like, metaphors and shit like that, which, you know, you got to judge a movie on in some way. But it was a good action flick. I mean, on top of that, too, I think it... You know, they blew up a lot of stuff, and they had some Hulk fights, and like Tony Stark had cool gadgets and shit. Like,
cool it's gadgets.
Things that we come to expect that about Victoria these movies.
Thing or whatever it's called. Yeah,
Veronica. Right.
Yeah, it was interesting. I did like, and this is clearly got to be like a Joss Whedon thing for sure, where it's like, oh man, Hawkeye, he lives out in the country, just wants to go back to his family, and he's married, and he's got kids, and there's another one on the way, and let me quick look at this picture of my family one last time before I stuff it in my wallet.
Oh man. I assumed he was going to die after that. Like, when you do something like that in a movie, that's foreshadowing that the character's going to die every time.
Yeah, but we, you know, Joss Whedon knows all these tropes and shit. The moment he did the photo thing, I was like, I don't know if this is, like, the most heavy-handed or if Joss Whedon's about ready to pull, like, the bait and switch and, you know, do whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to know if Quicksilver's actually dead or not. I feel like with Joss Whedon, he's kind of one of those dead people stay dead sort of things, except I don't watch Buffy, where I guess that rule didn't really apply that much at all. but magic, I suppose. But someone was pointing out that, like, they were interviewing, God, which Olsen is this? What's her name? Is this Elizabeth? Elizabeth Olsen? Yeah, and she was talking with Aaron Taylor Johnson about how, you know, don't feel too down about things, because one of my, you know, big, you know, things is magic and bringing people back to life or whatever. So I don't think it's going to happen. I think Avengers finally had to have one of those moments where it was like, guess what? Not all of us get to walk out at the end every time and go, I guess we saved the city this time. You know?
Well, that was Coulson in the last movie.
Yeah, well, to an extent. What happened there?
Well, that's a whole nother story about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But but speaking of the Maximoff twins, I mean, like,
right,
for something that I thought was gonna just be like real shoehorned in our throats, like, you have to eat this food, it's gonna be awful, but you need it. Like,
yeah,
I really didn't feel that way about the story. I felt like it was. Is a little pushy about the whole Tony Stark killed their family. Like,
right, what's the deal? Like, how many people has Tony Stark accidentally dropped his bombs on?
A lot of people.
That, like, now are coming back for vengeance. Yeah. Because I feel like this is the ongoing plot. Like, how many people have, you know, had a bomb with Stark Industries, you know, come through their house? Because it seems like, you know, everybody... And that felt like that was unresolved, too. Like, there was no conversation about that or no, like, oh, sorry about this or whoops. It was, like, it was never addressed. I mean, am I wrong? It was, like, never addressed.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because the sort of climactic scene, you know, the big action sequence at the end is they take this city where they lived and they literally turn their city into a weapon. And all these people's homes are destroyed and just kind of, like, shrugged off, like, well, we saved the rest of the planet.
Yeah,
like, here's right. People that have been, like, for decades, according to the movie, sort of, like, been subject to violence and war that they have no control over, and all of a sudden it's like, well, look, we saw your city is destroyed. Oops, you know.
Yeah.
There are some weird social, like, political things you could read into that, I think.
But to that point, though, I think it's the same thing that we're going to see as the repercussion. And I think it's so funny that this is my theory. So my theory about all of this is that, so the next movie in line is Ant-Man, and we're going to probably brush that off. But the next big storyline in terms of all of these movies is Cap 3. Cap 3, which is going to be all about Civil War, which is going to be about the repercussions of what superheroes do to the world. And I think that this movie, similar to what happened in Man of Steel, and I think what's going to be the story of Man of Steel, is that because of all this bad shit happening, registration happens in the Marvel Universe. Whereas in Batman vs. Superman, I think it's going to be, Batman's going to be like, look at what Superman did to Metropolis. We can't have this happen again. And so it's going to be Batman trying to bring down Superman with Lex Luthor, blah, blah, blah. That's a whole other topic. But I think, like, this, that was all brushed over because I think in the next movie, the next big movie in the storyline is going to be, you know, because of what happened in Avengers, the United States is going to be like, okay, we can't let that happen. We can't let Tony Stark be out of check with the government. Someone needs to be regulating him. And since S.H.I.E.L.D. is gone, we don't have anybody. And he and the rest of the Avengers have been, like, you know, the only people overseeing each other, and look at what's happening. We need someone else checking them. And so I think they brushed over it all because they want to make a whole movie about it rather than try to wrap it all up in 5 minutes.
Well, at least that's for being so good.
That's what feels like the natural storyline. But I mean, again, this is all theory. This is all me making shit up. But it feels in line with what we kind of already know about the next movie, especially since, you know, Robert Downey Jr. is going to be in Cap 3. I think that's what this next movie is going to be about.
Well, for being someone who basically doesn't know jack shit about Marvel, I did hear some interesting things that do sort of reaffirm what you were saying. I heard that in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., again, I don't watch it, but I know they're now having to deal with all of this Inhumans stuff, apparently.
Yep.
I guess that, and I hear that might be getting a spinoff as well, but anyway, I hear they're kind of trying to come to terms with how to control or classify in humans. So there's that on that front. But then I think it might have been with Joss Whedon or one of the producers, but they were asking, you know, how literal is this going to be a civil war sort of thing? And he said it's not, or at least who knows to what extent, it's not so much a literal registration issue, but they were saying it was more of a battle over who is accountable for the Avengers' actions and who is going to be the one in charge, in terms of Cap versus Iron Man. And I did think that they did scene very well in this movie for more of that antagonism to come between the two of them.
I agree.
I mean, when they're fighting over like what they're going to do with Vision, like you could clearly tell that this was already like, uh-oh, these two clearly have some issues with, you know, having an ends justify the means mentality versus a, you know, very much like morality above all sort of standpoint. So, and I hope it's not like literally a carbon copy Civil War. I mean, this is the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They already set themselves up where they, you know, they aren't obligated in any way to have to follow anything to a T. So, you know, whatever.
You know, Mike, you mentioned the connections or allusion to sort of Man of Steel, that the destruction of the city will lead into the next movie. When I was watching Age of Ultron, I was really struck by how many times in that last battle they made it a point to say, we have to save these people whose houses are being destroyed. We need to save these civilians. And there's all these scenes of the Avengers actually literally saving people during the fight. Was that a dig at Man of Steel, where you didn't see Superman save anybody?
Oh, man. Oh, I didn't even think of that.
That's
would
all
actually
I could think of.
He was busy.
He was busy.
He was
Superman.
Busy dealing with Michael Shannon chewing up as much scenery as possible.
Yeah.
Good God.
Oh, man. No, that's actually really funny. But I think that might be one of those things that maybe Marvel is trying. Maybe. I mean, I guess I'm agreeing with your point. I think that maybe that was them, because they did make a huge deal about, and I think
they
Marvel's
really,
all
yeah.
of Marvel's movies has actually done this. They made a huge deal about saving people. Like the characters go well out of their way to try to save someone. Like Hawkeye went and saved that kid, and he didn't like, not to say he didn't have to, but like, goddamn, the odds were not in his favor that day, and he went way out of his way, and thus the sacrifice, you know, like that was a huge moment in the movie, I think, obviously because they focus on it, but there were so many shots of Cap reeling people into one of the loading things, and like all the characters purposely running with a bunch of people saying, okay, we got to get to this thing, we got to get you off of this thing. And
I mean, to be fair, not to be a dick, but it wasn't one of those things where you could be like, everybody stay in your homes, because it's not like that was going to work. Right. You know, like that couldn't even be a viable thing. It was like, everybody, we're at this altitude, so clearly, you know. But you're right. It was like, hey, guess what? We actually have to be aware of the fact that we're, you know, going to save people and everything. And I think that's interesting when you juxtapose that scene with the scene earlier when the Hulk goes absolutely batshit insane.
Oh, yeah.
And you
yeah.
just see all of these people that are just shocked. And that scene where he just destroys that whole building top to bottom.
No
oh
worry
goodness.
About the people around in the city either. Like, right. And that's something that someone else pointed out to me, that like that scene was like death and destruction.
That scene was, holy cow.
Like a lot of people died there. Like the implications, they didn't show any like dead bodies, but like there's no way Hulk jumped on a car and didn't kill those people. Like,
right. You weren't going to be able to talk your way out of that, or, you know, have a cutaway with the camera and be like, look, everyone's fine.
Yeah, and I'm sure. And I think that was part of like the scene that followed with Bruce Banner on the ship realizing what had happened. Like, and God, they did such a good job just playing with everyone's like emotions in that. Like, I think they tore all of the characters apart really, really well. And specifically with Bruce, like with his biggest thing being, I realize I have this thing in me that could harm a lot of people. And as much as I may think I have it under control, look at what happens when I don't, you know? So I don't know. Comparing those two scenes, it's night and day, determining, you know, between like who survived and who didn't.
And like, I want them to get back to, and maybe it's sort of this fear of like never really having complete control or dominance, but like, can we talk about this whole like Hulk is like, guess what, you know, I'm always angry, so I can do whatever I want whenever I want with the first one. And then in the second one, it's like, well, maybe he's not in control, but then again, maybe he is in control. But then again, at the end, you know, he has the cognitive facilities and whatnot to run a, what, like the jet and everything. So clearly, and he's like depressed, and you can clearly tell he's meant to be like more human.
Well,
in that moment, sort of dwelling on everything, and it's like, where's the line being drawn? And that's such a comic book thing to say. Of like, can you specify exactly what level of control he's got? But maybe that's the whole point. It's like it's all over the place, and you really never know. I guess a lot of people thought that we were going to get Grey Hulk in this or something like that. But that, you know, didn't come about. So,
I mean, Paul, I mean, I don't know how much of Hulk's history you know. I can't say that I'm like a master or anything, but do you know much about the Hulk that you could speak to that?
Not enough where I could, you know, really say too much. I know that that's the Hulk's ability to control his emotion, or Hulk's intelligence when he's the Hulk, is it fluctuates throughout his history. It'd be interesting if they show it developing. Like, maybe Bruce Banner slowly is able to control it more when he's the Hulk. You know what I mean? Have their personalities sort of blend together a little bit more. I don't know if we're actually going to get a Hulk movie, but this kind of makes me want to see one. Especially Mark Ruffalo just acts his ass off in this movie. Right. I'd love to see him keep doing that character. So if they're hinting at a deeper Hulk story, I'm all for it. Like I said, sad Hulk movie, make it happen. Sad Hulk movie.
I know from the handful of comics, you know, and I say handful, I mean probably like a couple hundred comics that I've read that have the Hulk in them. So I mean, not to say I know everything about the Hulk, and that number is probably a little more exaggerated than I mean, but
you know more than us though.
But,
so you know, go ahead.
From what I've read, you know, like the Hulk, like you said, Paul, the control over that, or intelligence that the Hulk has, is constantly varying. But that also depends on his level of rage, depending on the situation he's in, and depending on who's fucking writing the book, obviously.
Right.
But I know that, and they implied it in this movie, and I thought I loved the line that Tony said. You know, okay, Bruce, it's calmed down, and then the Hulk flips shit. And he's like, okay, don't mention the little guy. Because, like, this idea of the Hulk hates Bruce Banner because he, you know, like, this is a thing. This is a very common theme in all the Hulk movies, I think, as well as all the Hulk comics that I've ever read, where Bruce Banner and the Hulk are two separate entities that occupy the same organic space in a way. And they are two sides of this, maybe the same man, or is the Hulk an actual person and Bruce Banner is just his weak side? And it's constantly back and forth depending on who's writing, depending on the story. But the fact that Hulk recognizes Bruce Banner, knows that he can turn back into this thing, is a very, very deep story in terms of Hulk's history. If you read any of Peter David's run, even if you read Planet Hulk or something like that, something smaller, like that is a thing. Like, Bruce Banner wants to detach himself from the Hulk, and for a while they were separate entities and they came back together. And I don't think we're going to see anything as complex as that in movies or any type of film or anything, but that idea that the Bruce Banner and the Hulk are aware of each other's existence and know, like, that the Hulk isn't just this brooding dumb idiot, that he actually has he actually can think for himself and knows that if he gives up being the Hulk, then he will no longer have the ability to come out unless Bruce wills it so. Like, that's a whole huge thing where, like, the Hulk and Bruce Banner have been fighting for years in the comics internally about who has control over this person. And that, to me, that's a totally cool story. I don't, like you said, you know, if we can see a movie or something with that, that would be awesome. But you know, with sad Hulk flying off, we're probably not going to. But I think it's going to be a part of the next two Avengers movies. Where's the Hulk? How do we get the Hulk to stop? He's been the Bruiser. We don't have a Bruiser anymore. What do we do? I think we'll be a part of the next two Avengers films at least. So I really appreciate that they at least touched on that.
Well, it's good that you're seeing it here, because unfortunately, I don't know if you guys heard, Universal still owns the rights to solo Hulk movies.
Right.
Marvel can't even do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the thing. And you know what? It reminds me a lot of, I don't know if you follow these characters much, Mike. I'm sure, Paul, you know a little bit. It reminds me a ton of the whole Jason Blood slash Etrigan sort of scenario, in a way. You know, where yeah. one, where they yeah. have to, you know, they possess the same body, and then, you know, when one, you know, is in hell, the other one is on Earth, and then they have to switch, and it's interesting, and I really wish that we could have, you know, Mark Ruffalo just act the shit out of that and turn it into, you know, a real sort of psychological battle between the two. I don't know how many like that, but you know, sometimes, you know, deceit and deception are the best ways to people to expand their horizons. So there you go.
Yeah. So to wrap this up, overall, out of 10, what do you guys give Avengers Age of Ultron? Let's do that. Let's put a number on it, because we'll be jackasses about it.
I don't believe in I don't believe in quantifying art. So, no, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Nick, go ahead. Go ahead.
7.5/8.
Okay. Okay. Paul?
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Nick. I would say between 7 and 8. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think... yeah, no. I think I would give it, you know, probably a solid 7. Honestly, I think there were some, you know, I'm going to justify it because I'm talking less, but I think there were some stumbling points, but at the same time, it was definitely a good bridging movie to the final section.
And if anything else, I mean, I think
things.
We forgot to talk about this, but the whole, God, what is his name? Why do I always forget this guy's name? He was Gollum. He was Gollum. Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
what's that guy's name?
I know who you're talking about. Yes, the
why we blink.
It's yeah, the one I want to say, I can't remember his name. Whatever, the guy that played Gollum was
Andy
in the movie.
Andy Serkis. Mm-hmm. Holy cow! Like, what a great little cameo. What a great scene. Funny dialogue. And again, I don't know much about Marvel, but I turned to Jordan, and Jordan was like, "You realize like this is setting up Wakanda and Black Panther.
Oh,
and he's
yeah.
probably going to be the bad guy
right,
in the Black
right.
Panther movie."
Oh my
and
gosh!
And I was like, "Oh, what a fun little scene, though. I love it when he's like, you know, he's like, I don't want to talk to you guys. I only talk to the boss or whatever."
Yeah.
And then Ultron just like shows up, and he's like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah. There's a lot of Easter eggs in the movie, which I have to give them credit for, but we're done talking about Ultron. We're going to move on. So I think we're going to take another intentional break really quick, and we're going to come right back.
Well, last Saturday was a free comic book day. It's been a pretty big deal for the past couple years, and I participated, and I assume both of you did to some extent, or did you both decide that, you know, you were going to, you know, not participate in this big deal?
I took part mainly because I hadn't picked up my books for the week yet, so it was my excuse to go to the store. But there were actually a few things this year that I was interested in checking out. I mean, by and large, for Free Comic Book Day, it's exciting to see comic book stores full of people, but the usual offerings that publishers have for free are sometimes underwhelming. There are a few things this year that caught my eye. The DC Divergence preview. I actually quite enjoyed. There was the Hip Hop Family Tree 3-in-1 sampler from Ed Piskor. I enjoyed that. And the 2000 AD sampler definitely caught my eye, and I enjoyed that. But yeah, overall, good to see a lot of people in the store. Yeah, Mike, what did you think of Free Comic Book Day?
Oh, this year I was unable to participate in Free Comic Book Day, mostly because I was out looking for an apartment. But also, on the other hand, I knew that I wasn't going to be gone all day, but I didn't actually go out to a comic book shop. So I live in New York City now, and I could have, you know, I had a plethora of comic book shops I could have gone to. But the idea of going, like, normally, you know, living in Grand Rapids, you know, the comic book shops are really, really packed on Free Comic Book Day. The idea of going to a comic book shop in New York City on Free Comic Book Day, like, turned my stomach. Only because of the sheer number of people I knew were going to be there. And I know that, like, I should have gone out and I should have done it or whatever. But at the same time, my thought is every Free Comic Book Day, for the past couple of years, I actually haven't picked up much. Like, the first 2 years, I think, I went to Free Comic Book Day, and this was like 7-8 years ago, you know, I picked up as many books as I could. But as the years have gone on, I've picked up less and less, not out of, like, disinterest, but out of the fact that I'm not there to pick up these comics to get hooked. Mm-hmm. I'm there to, you know, if I'm picking up a Free Comic Book Day book, it's because I'm probably picking up something that I've never read before. And my thought is, you know, I'm not going to pick up the Marvel book. I'm not going to pick up the DC book. I already kind of know what's going on in the big books. If there's somebody from Image or from a smaller publisher that I would never normally read, I'd probably pick it up because that's a free ticket for me to potentially try this series out. You know, I'm a big fan of the idea of try before you buy, especially in terms of, like, free one-off issues and stuff like that, or free number ones or something. And I'm not saying they should all be like that, but, you know, for Free Comic Book Day, my thought this year was, you know, if I don't go, then that means one more person could potentially get those comics. And that's not to say that I sound noble about it, because I'm really not. I was just lazy and I didn't, you know, want to go face the crowds. But I kind of justified it in my mind as, you know, if I didn't go, maybe someone picked up that book that I was probably going to get. And maybe there's a new comic book reader because of it. I mean, Free Comic Book Day is kind of weird to me in the sense that, like, a lot of people go out to Free Comic Book Day just to get all the free comics, and they are people that hoard those comics and they don't get anything else. They come into a shop and they will get 20 free comic books if the shop will let them, and they won't buy a single thing. And to me, that is not something that I'm a big fan of. And I realize that a lot of the times it's because it's kids or it's because it's families that don't normally buy books and stuff like that. But on the other hand, Nick, I know you brought this up in the pre-show, that there are people out there who are selling full lots, like where they grabbed every single free comic book for, you know, and they're selling it online for a bunch of money, or they're selling rare copies of things, you know, that not all shops had, or there weren't a lot of copies of, for a bunch of money. And I think that kind of takes away from the spirit of what Free Comic Book Day is. Like, the industry goes way, way, way out of their way, in my mind, to put out all of these free books, and they put out a lot of them. And if someone's going out there just to try to make money off of it, then that's kind of like, it's a real shitty thing to do. So I'm kind of torn on the idea of it, because if it's me getting real elitist about comic books and saying, well, if you can't put your money into this system, you don't deserve to be in this system in the first place. But I know that's not the right mentality to have, but I get a little bitter about it. So I didn't participate this year in a strange combination of those things. So you guys come back at me. Tell me how big of an asshole I am now.
No, I mean, you raise some good points. You run into that issue where you do have speculators grabbing the free books, or people just loading up on freebies without actually buying anything. I mean, those books aren't free to the stores. The stores have to pay for those, the free comic books give out. So if you go to the shop and you don't buy anything, you're dicking the store over. As far as people speculating, that's always going to be the case. You're always going to have people that are sort of taking advantage of these things. I think the publishers could have a better system to avoid that. I feel like making things exclusive, or having the first issues, like the DC and Marvel books are basically just previews for their big events. Those are things people are going to want to have. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Are you trying to say that, like, these books should be intros to the universes rather than, like, pieces of a greater story that you'll need to read in order to get those stories?
Yeah, thanks you for catching my train of thought there. Yeah, Mike. No, that's exactly right. The point I was going to make. I was standing in line waiting to get into one of the shops I went to on Saturday, and they had handed out the Secret Wars previews for free to people in line. Yep. And I actually heard a couple people in line behind me who weren't regular comic book readers, who had just shown up to get free comics and see what it was about, to take part in the sort of excitement of the day, and they're flipping through the book and they had no idea what was going on. They're like, is this a preview for the books that are going to be inside? I'm like, not really. It's just a preview for the other Marvel books that are coming out. And the Secret Wars already is something that even as a comic fan, I have no, very little understanding of. So for new fans, it's impenetrable. Whereas I feel like other books that are just more samplers, introductions to series or even just here's a sampling of all the books we publish, that goes over a lot better. And I feel there's less incentive to capitalize on that on the secondary market if they're just samplers or reprints of other material. That's what's going to attract new readers, I think, whereas as much as I like the Divergence thing, I can't imagine anyone who hasn't read DC books for the past year making any sense of it. So
you're completely right. I'm always kind of torn on like what exactly should be the goal of the books being put out, and then on top of that, like who exactly is Free Comic Book Day for? Someone might be like, "Well, it's for everyone, Nick." Well, that's bullshit, and I don't agree with that answer. That's way too simple. But yeah, it's sort of like you get these ones that are big, just samplings of all the different titles. I know Boom, I think has like 10 different stories, 10 different like 2-page stories, and that was kind of neat. But then you've also got DC, where it's like you can't lie to yourself about that book. It's clearly not for anybody looking to try to get into comics. It's for, you know, readers that are already engaging in this stuff, but. There were some other interesting ones. I picked up, let's see, what did I get? I think I got the Tick DC book, the Dark Circle book. That looked really interesting to me, where you get a story of the Shield, you get a story of the Fox, which I've read some of the Fox, and what is it, Black Hood, Black Mask?
Yeah, Black Hood, something. I think.
Yeah. I got the Bob's Burgers. In 2000 AD, wow, like they did not skimp on that thing. Holy cow,
that I was gonna say, that's the best example of what they should be doing. And I realize it might not be economically feasible since it's such a big book for every publisher to do it, but that's 48 pages. You had at least 8 different stories in there that are all sort of like little standalone samples. Yeah, that I thought was fantastic. If that's the way you want to hook new readers, 2000 AD nailed it.
And that was perfectly. Free, right? That, and like, I mean, I know it's Free Comic Book Day, but that's free for that, right?
Yeah,
right.
48 pages of free insane. Comics. Yeah.
See, that reminds me of Mouse Guard. For 2 years or something, Mouse Guard was putting out hardcover, like limited print, like obviously very limited print, but like hardcover Free Comic Book Day for like, it's like 28 pages in a hardcover book that you could just walk into the shop and you could get. And like Mouse Guard, that's a whole nother caliber of comic book as far as I'm concerned. Like David Peterson, like he is up there in terms of people that love to create comic books. Like he's one of those creators that I have a massive amount of respect for because he is one of the nicest people you could talk to at a convention. He's been at every convention I've ever been to, or he's been at every C2E2 at least, and he is always polite. Like he's got a ton of books. Like he wants to not only he's selling himself, like he puts his heart and soul into his books, and like that right there is proof that Arkea like believes in him. And like I credit that dude with every high praise you could possibly give a comic creator, because that dude is top notch, like straight up. And they like that right there is proof that he believes it and his publisher believes in that too. Like, but yeah, like, and that, and seeing this is like the side of Free Comic Book Day that I really like, you know, that like the idea of these publishers going above and beyond to try to make readers want to read their books by putting out these high quality things that have a lot of content and are meant to not only hook you on the book, because like we said before, comic books publishers out there to try to sell books, but like to do it in such a way that isn't just like, I don't know, that isn't cheap, you know, or isn't, you know, in your face with speculative or big like spectacles. Instead, they're like, here is quality. This is what we promise to deliver you every time, you know?
Right.
And I'd really like to see some of the bigger publishers maybe trying to put out 2 books or even 3 where there's something that's more for hooking the newer reader, and then something that's maybe more for the more established. I mean, I know DC did Divergence, and then they did Teen Titans Go, which was clearly they were going with like a kids approach versus an adult approach, or something like that. But it'd be nice to see something, you know, where they're really addressing both crowds, because DC's Divergence was not, you know, was not going to attract younger readers. And I think Marvel at least, Marvel had Secret Wars, and then they had, God, what did Xander call it? It was such a hilarious title. All New, comma, All Different Avengers.
Oh, yeah. That's actually the name of a new book, I think.
I love that. I love that title. That's I don't know why, but that's just fantastic. I mean, yeah, I really was thinking a lot and sort of struggling with, like, who exactly is this supposed to be targeting? Who is this supposed to be bringing out to the stores?
Well, it obviously brings out a lot of people. Like,
it does.
Yeah. By and large, I was surprised to see, like, the lines of pictures of the lines of multiple stores from all across the United States. Like, people that were waiting in line for, I assume, maybe an hour or 2 hours or something just to get into, like, grab these free comic books, and I guarantee you, like, probably 7 out of 10 people bought something that day. Like, as much as I gripe about, like, people just coming in and just grabbing the free comics and leaving, I think more people than not buy comics every time they do that. They're like, oh, I heard about this saga book, and I know places like Vault of Midnight in Grand Rapids, I know they're really big on free comic book day, and I guarantee you most people that walked into that shop walked out with something else on top of their free comic books.
And I can tell you that a lot of these stores were carefully, and I don't want to be too cynical about this, but they were carefully set up, and I'm sure, Paul, you noticed this as well, they were carefully set up in a way where, you know, the line that led to wherever the free comics were very slowly ushered you past, like, a whole lot of stuff to look at and consider buying. And it worked, because I bought three things, including Multiversity 2, which, quick shout out, what's the deal, $6, what the hell.
They can charge whatever they want because it's Grant Morrison, and who cares, right? Like,
right, exactly. I'm sure Grant probably has some stupid wheel in his house, and he spun it, and he's like, oh, $6, that's what we landed on, that's what we're doing. But yeah, I don't know. It's tough as well, because I hope you're right, and I hope people are buying stuff, because I don't want to be the person that, like you said, is like, look, if you don't have any money to contribute to this industry, you know, get out. And you don't want to be that person that's like, hey, maybe they need to put a sign up or something. But it's true. Like, these are literally not free comics. I mean, stores having to pay for them, and it's, I don't know. I just feel bad when you see these people that are just, you know, it's, comic books are not an industry where, you know, they can, at least in my mind, they can afford to be just throwing out free stuff left and right. You know, a store lives and dies on the fact that they can't put too much stuff on the shelf that isn't already, you know, it lives and dies on the pull system, basically. You know, they're not going to put too much stuff on the shelf that they don't know if it's ever going to sell.
Right.
So, but I don't know. I'm torn on that. If some of these people that aren't buying anything get hooked, and that's, you know, that's great. You know, and if they're just buying the comics and reading them and enjoying them, and that's it, as long as they aren't frickin' putting them on eBay at the end of the day, you know what? I'll respect that person over the eBay guy, you know, 9 times out of 10. So, I don't know. It's tricky stuff. But I would love to hear the story behind these people that put the entire 50-issue set online. What's going on there? Because it sounds like that's not easily acquired without some sort of, like, insider, you know, hook. I don't know.
Yeah, but the biggest thing to remember about all this is that, like, you know, obviously this is, these publishers go out of their way to publish this. These shops buy a lot of these books because they want to bring in, you know, they want to bring in the traffic. But the flip side of this is that none of these are available online, which makes the scarcity grow, you know, 100 times, you know, because, like, if you can only get these books and read these books, you know, for free by walking into a shop, that, like, that to me seems like the comic book industry and all the major publishers, or any of the publishers out there who are putting out free comics for Free Comic Book Day, it makes me seem like that's them saying, we still protect our brick and mortar stores. And I don't think that that's necessarily, like, that's not true. And you know, every other day of the year, I think that comic shops or comic publishers are still like, we want to support our brick and mortar stores, but we also want to give the alternative to buy things online. Like, I think that's what made the whole eBay thing seem more feasible this year. And I don't know if I haven't heard about this before in the past. Of this happening, but like with how big digital has become in the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, or especially in the last 2 years, I think, like seeing something like that doesn't necessarily surprise me. It just kind of makes me frown, saying like, I understand that the only way you could get these is to buy them or get them physically in a shop, but like that doesn't mean you should necessarily capitalize on it, you know? Because, I mean, I read a lot of digital, you know, and so, like, I'm not going to be able to read any of those books unless I walk into a shop and they still have copies or I borrow them from somebody. So, it's kind of a weird situation. But I do have to, like, credit the industry by saying this is only available in a physical format because that's where, I mean, in a way, maybe it's them saying this is where comics began, this is where comics live, that's why it's important to represent in that way, rather than saying, okay, you could just get it online, because I bet you, you know, if somebody like me who buys a lot of digital, if I could get all those online, I would have never walked into a shop to begin with, and I mean, I didn't this year, but that's, you know, a completely different subject matter, but I think probably half the people that walked into shops this year, if they could have got them online, they wouldn't have walked into the shop that day. You know, there's no reason.
Yeah. and to be honest, like with a lot of these books, I don't really know. Gosh, this is going to sound awful. I don't really know if a lot of the stories and whatnot that are being told here are truly compelling or crucial to the point that I think with a lot of them, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, I have to find out. Because it's not like this week, Free Comic Book Day is Batman, you know, Batman 40 or whatever, you know. And if you don't come and pick it up today, then you'll never know how Endgame ends or something like that. You know, I think a lot of these don't have that sort of compelling factor. Which I think in a way, I sort of like what Transformers versus G.I. Joe did last year, where they made, I think they made their Free Comic Book Day issue zero of their series,
right. Yeah.
Which like, I like that approach where it's an introduction, but it's not crucial. It also feels like the beginning of something. So
it hooks you and makes you want to buy number one.
Yeah, exactly. And I realize not every book can do that, but I thought that was a pretty novel approach, because with a lot of the other ones, it's like, well, this is kind of interesting, or, you know, this is a sampling or whatever, but it's not some of the stuff that I'm gonna like really go out of my way. Or like Bongo, their book for Free Comic Book Day is, to my knowledge, it's always brand new stuff. It's stuff that's just completely written for Free Comic Book Day, and it works perfectly because with The Simpsons or with Futurama, you know, none of their stuff carries really from issue to issue. So they just do a completely brand new issue for Free Comic Book Day, and the new readers love it, and the people that already pick it up, you know, they're not feeling like they're retreading stuff. So I think there are, you know, certain things that can be done to make Free Comic Book Day even more compelling / accessible at the same time. I think what sort of gets glossed over, and it's not that we haven't sort of thought about it, or not that, you know, listeners aren't going to consider it, but I think really one of the bigger points that I think is still valid about Free Comic Book Day is that you are actually running into other readers or encountering people in line that you can, you know, talk to about, you know, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? Because, you know, for most of us, we tend to go to the comic book shop, or at least I do. I tend to go, you know, every Wednesday, usually at the same time, which usually means I run into this guy, and this guy. And it's not to say that I don't enjoy talking with some of those people I do, but it's always kind of fascinating on something like Free Comic Book Day or something like that to run into the people that maybe they buy their comics on Saturday, or maybe you've never seen them before because maybe they buy, you know, they show up once a month or something. But an event like this, you know, gets everybody, you know, for the most part together, and you can actually run into sort of a different crowd that, you know, oddly enough, you know, they go to the same place as you, and they read the same things, and, you know, and whatnot, but you never really encounter them until something like this. So,
that's interesting, because that reiterates my feeling that as they might slowly be diminishing, but you'll never completely lose the brick and mortar shops.
Right.
Because there's always going to be that communal experience of going. It's the same thing with Record Store Day. I mean, Record Store Day is kind of a hassle because the record store is jammed full of people, but it's exciting to be in a place where people want to be. People are excited to talk about whatever they're talking about, music or comics. That communal aspect of being a fan is something that you don't normally have. With digital, I mean, you have message boards and all that, but there's something different about being face to face in a space with someone where you can enjoy your fandom. That's something that all types of nerd fandom need. So safe places like that.
Thank you for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. Produced by Mike Rappin, and produced and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Cold Electric and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep up with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you have any questions, or would like us to talk about something on the podcast, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at @destroythecyb, and on Tumblr at destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And again, thanks for listening.
Do you have thoughts about the Bobby Drake reveal, Mike?
When I wrote this, I hadn't read it, and I read the issue two nights ago. I'm really torn on the subject because the way that they did it
was... What subject?
Bobby Drake being gay.
I was making coffee. Okay.
The topic itself doesn't bother me because I think, like, the way that they did it seems like totally... If you've read all 40 issues of All New X-Men, you see Bobby Drake throughout the whole thing. I know, right? So if you've read it and you see Bobby Drake from issue one being this kind of like sexist little 16-year-old, kind of the way you would expect dumb, immature 16-year-olds to be, where you're kind of like, God damn it, Bobby, that's not the right thing to say, but you giggle because you go, he doesn't know what he's doing, or, and that's not an excuse, you know, I'm not saying that's an excuse. I'm just saying, like, you 16-year-olds
don't you defend him.
16-year-olds like tend to be that way, and what they're doing isn't right. But, like, that's what you expect of 16-year-olds. So, at the end of the series, you know, issue 40, I don't think that's the last issue, but Jean Grey just goes, Bobby, why do you do that? And he's like, what? She's like, why do you say these things when you're... And he's like, what are you talking about, Jean? And she's like, when you're gay. And he's like, Jean, what the hell is your problem? He's like, Bobby. She's like, Bobby, no, it's fine. Apparently, people in this time don't think it's that big of a deal, whereas back home, they would have a problem with it. He's like, this is not true because I grew up and look at, I dated all these women. And then Jean Grey goes, well, he didn't date them that well. Like, nothing turned out for him. He's like, well, he even dated Kitty Pryde. And he's like, well, she's not dating him anymore. And it's like, in my head,
Bobby's,
I'm like,
just like, if I wasn't gay before, now you've made me. Terrible.
I don't know how to think about it, because at one hand, I'm like, that's an interesting twist on the character, but on the other hand, I'm like, isn't that kind of like a bastardization of all the like good that Marvel has been trying to do for like the LGBT community? Like saying, like, we're just gonna turn this straight character gay just to make an, you know, add another, you know, gay character to the Marvel universe. It's like, just establish a new person. Like,
you're saying,
I don't know.
It was like a twist that if you went back, it wasn't one of those things where if you went back and read, you know, read between the lines and everything, it was like, you could tell it was like slowly planned. This felt like it was just sort of a snap decision.
I don't know if it was like that, because when I think about it, and like I read an article with Bendis, and he was like, I don't remember if he said that he had planned it all along, but in my mind...
Well, that would be what I would say regardless. But
yeah,
I mean,
but at the same time, I feel like he's been writing Bobby, like, abhorrently, like, sexist. Like nonstop making comments about cleavage and how hot girls are. And, like, the kind of... It's that stupid 80s cliche.
Do you think that's supposed to be him, like,
overcompensating? Yeah, and it's that 80s cliche of him overcompensating to try to hide the fact. And, like, but they didn't do anything to insinuate any sort of homosexual, like... homosexuality in the character, but just other than that. And I'm like, that's a one-dimensional 80s trope, Bendis, that you just pulled out of the fucking TV tropes database. And
you just go back to like issue 17 and he's actually wearing a shirt with like size 2 font that says I'm gay.
Right, you, I don't think it's anything like that. Look real close. I don't know how to feel about it because in my mind, like, this sounds like
you don't like your, you know, your... You have, you're homophobic. We get it.
Yeah,
like,
no, it's completely opposite because in my mind, I think that doesn't change the character at all for me because he's still Bobby Drake, you know, like,
right.
And I mean, like, I'm not to say that it doesn't matter that it happened, but like, quite honestly, that's not the that character isn't defined by his sexuality. And, like, they made it such a big, I mean, I guess the internet made it such a big fucking thing that now I'm just like, I'm like kind of like, God damn it, you guys fucked up a really good opportunity to like involve someone of a different like sexual orientation, and instead you just kind of like plopped it on people rather than building it naturally. And maybe I need to go back and reread 40 issues of All New X-Men, but I swear to God, I've been reading that since issue one, and it felt out of place. It felt weird, and it felt just like it was dumped on us as the readers with no buildup. And like, maybe I missed cursory glances, maybe I missed insinuations throughout the series and misreading them or just glossing over them because I was reading the rest of the story and not paying attention to that aspect of it. But like, it really feels out of left field, especially because Jean Grey's like, I've known the whole time, blah blah blah, I've been reading your mind, and blah. And I mean, that's been her thing throughout the whole series, but like, they didn't, I don't know, I don't think it was well handled. And if it was Bendis's,
do you think it should have been handled better, or do you think this was just not a scene that even needed to be a thing?
That whole issue didn't need to happen. Quite honestly, right. It was a very bad issue of that series.
And you said this is like the end of the whole.
I think it's coming. I think they're ending pretty soon. And Bendis is doing that thing where he's just kind of. Bendis is doing that thing that all comic books do when they're about to end and they don't know what to do, but they have about 2 months to kill or 3 months to kill, where they're just like, here are filler one-off issues that like really are just kind of like nothing, and somebody else probably wrote it, but like it's not that good and it's not bad, and you're kind of sticking with it because you're a continuity or you're a. You know, you're someone like me and you're a completionist and you need to read all the issues.
You've got the rest of the issues,
Yeah, you're like, I don't want to not read these because what if something happens? And then something like this happens and you're like, that's not what I wanted to happen. I wanted like another thing to happen, you know? And it's not about him being gay. It's just that like where I just didn't see it coming, and it's not one of those things where like Jean Grey was the bad guy the whole time and I should have seen it coming. It's like... He's gay now, and you're like, oh, wait. There was a whole other storyline going on. All right. And this totally negates 30 or 40 years worth of fucking story. And it's like, oh, wait a second, Mike. Take a step back. Please sit down. I need to tell you something, Mike. This is me talking to me. You're reading Marvel. And then and then other me goes, oh, right. Just like Grant Morrison's new X-Men, just like everything that's been happening for the last 10 years in X-Men, they're just going to dump something on you and you got to run with it. And this time it happens to be something that's more of a societal issue than a character like Magneto was Zorn the whole time. He couldn't possibly kill anybody, right? Says Marvel's editor in chief. Like, so I'm love comic books.